If you need information, you'll have to send an email, heartofmindradio@gmail.com. Apparently there's a snafu happening with the phone, but you can still email me at heartofmindradio@gmail.com. We're going to go back and listen to a little bit of Miles Davis, Love for Sale.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, oh yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Speaking of the imagination, my guest this morning is Sunny Moraine. Don't know yet. Just a thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. When I went to see Suicide Squad, a kid, about 8 years old, I'd guess, was seated next to me. Look, I've never raised kids, so I'm not going to question the parenting approaches of anyone else. Kid seemed to be enjoying himself in any case. But what he enjoyed more than anything else was the Geico commercial that preceded the film. You probably have seen this. It's the one with the pirates where the parrot starts ragging on the captain's crew. The kid really started cackling when the parrot started talking about how bad the shipmates all smelled. And I don't know, for some reason, that reaction kind of filled me with joy. I mean, sophisticated humor is all well and good. I'm happy for the Noel Cowards and David Sedarises of the world. But there's something to be said for reveling in the pure juvenilia of raunchy humor, don't you think? At the beginning of Sausage Party, the main characters, a group of food items stocked on the shelves of an immense supermarket, prime among them a hot dog voiced by Seth Rogen and a hot dog bun voiced by Kristen Wiig, sing a song welcoming the gods, us human shoppers, and expressing their hopes that they'll be scooped off the shelves and taken to what they call the great beyond, a kind of Valhalla that the products think exists beyond the four walls of their store. But since this is an R-rated, CG-animated film whose co-writers include Rogen, Evan Goldberg, and Jonah Hill, it isn't long before the song shifts to themes of a more carnal nature. These are food items with sex drives. There is a pronounced build-up to the first invocation of the word that rhymes with duck, and from that point forward, the profanities flow fast and easy. Really, the only thing wrong with this is that there is a certain self-consciousness to it all. The producers may as well have flashed a title that says, "Hey, we're making an R-rated cartoon" on the bottom of the screen each time a character drops an expletive. But to be honest, the delight the creators, including co-directors Conrad Vernon and Greg Tiernan, are having in violating all the kid film taboos, there's drinking and drugs and mass murder as well, it's all pretty infectious. For all the raunchiness and mayhem, there's a distinct lack of malice to Sausage Party. By the time the film works up to its closing orgy, with just about every sexual permutation avidly enacted by the cast of anthropomorphized products, the perversions are rendered with such unabashed joy, you can't really be annoyed at how blatant it all is. Rogen and company do toy with deeper themes, most prominently the character's crisis of faith, as they discover that the great beyond outside their store's doors is actually a torture chamber stocked with knives, ovens, and pots of boiling oil. And the film tries to tweak other animation studios, most prominently Pixar. But it all really seems tangential to getting down and getting raunchy. The most radical notion the film can come up with is the suggestion that bath salts will open up your consciousness to an alternate reality, one where food items walk and talk and have a profound desire to survive. There are isolated moments of brilliance, the best of which is when an overturned shopping cart leads to a sequence rendering the resulting disaster as not unlike a graphic survey of a mid-combat battlefield. But Sausage Party is mostly determined to use its R rating as a way to justify itself. It's fortunate that it's done with enough brio, that it's pretty much all that it needs. Director Khosrow Farahani is also trying to break format with his horror film, The Good Neighbor. In his case, he takes the now tedious found footage horror genre, and in telling the tale of two teens who decide to torture their elderly and antisocial neighbor, Mr. Graney, played by James Caan, by bugging his house and trying through technical means to convince him he's being haunted, throws in off-routes out of the video feed and into a courtroom where the aftermath of the experiment is being tried, as well as into flashbacks that reveal aspects of Graney that his tormentors are not aware of. It's not a bad approach, but Farahani holds until too late some details of the teenager's motivations that might have gone a long way towards keeping us from dismissing them as merely the pair of sociopaths they present themselves as through most of the film, and he provides a mildly Shyamalan-esque twist in a coda of flashbacks that aren't quite finessed enough to have the full impact. I welcome any attempt to prove that the found footage horror film still has potential, but The Good Neighbor offers up that potential without fully capitalizing on the opportunity. I'm Dan Persons. The polls are tightening. Don't presume that the orange one is his own worst enemy. We must fight against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
Was that it? Oh, dear. Yeah, that was it. And here I am just having too much fun, too much fun. Talking about Star Wars is Sonny Moraine. So as I was saying, so instead of the Wookiee planet, they just...
Endor.
Well, no, reverse Wookiee. Say it. Take Wookiee and say it backwards.
Ewok, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Ewok is something the marketers could work with, not Wookiee. So that's how that happened. And after that, it was all downhill. Good morning, everybody. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial, Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. In my younger days, I could have done that without the breath. Or the breath would have been blowing smoke into the microphone. Usually tobacco, but not always. But hey, it's WBAI. So, before we get to the wonderful fun business of speaking with Sonny Moraine, who came all the way from D.C. to be
it's
with
not
us.
That far. Also, my sister lives in Brooklyn. So.
Yeah, well, yeah, but still, I'm so, it's ego boo for me that you would do that.
Aww.
It really is. And, well, I see you know how to use a microphone to not talk directly into it.
I told you, I do my own podcast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which we'll talk about.
But
I have to promote this Tuesday, September, is it September? Yeah, 27th, at 7 o'clock in this very building, 388 Atlantic Avenue. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will not be on the first Tuesday of the month, as we generally are. The first Tuesday of October is Rosh Hashanah. The second Tuesday is The second Tuesday is the eve of Yom Kippur. There is no winning. The third Tuesday would be the day before KGB, Ellen Datlow and Matt Kressel's fine reading series. And we try to maintain a buffer between us, so that, you know, we get different audiences, but there's a crossover, and people should have the choice of attending both. So, and then the fourth Tuesday in October just didn't, I don't remember what it was. Look at your calendar, and you'll see why I couldn't do one.
And I'm in Poland in the beginning of October, so.
Yeah. So, ooh.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
I have to tell us more about that. So we're doing the last Tuesday in November. November 8th was a Thursday, but it was the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. So we had to do the Star Trek thing. But so our official September reading, or possibly October reading, will be September 27th. Nobody special. She's been on the show a dozen times. Nora Jemison. Oh, I'm sorry. Hugo Award-winning bleeping N.K. Jemison. Yay. If you were listening 2 weeks ago, she was our guest. We conned her because Lister, who goes on the air at 3 a.m. with Burn Baby Burn Clappers, wasn't here. He was on vacation, and so the show normally ends at 3. About 4:10, Nora's blinking her eyes, saying, haven't we been on for a while? I'm going, yes. I twicked her. She was wonderful. You know, she and I were both falling asleep on the air, but she was fabulous as always. So she will be our reader, along with Kai Ashante Wilson, who is a rising star. I didn't want to make the mistake, although I offered her the mistake of pairing her with somebody like Daniel Jose Older. But, you know, that's throwing people into the same bucket. I hate doing that. I don't. Yes, I know this year we had all gay people in June. I couldn't help it. They were in from England. What do you do? Well, you say, all right, it's Gay Pride Month. We're having a pride reading. Yeah, but I just as soon do it in March. I defy when last season we started out the season with Chip Delaney, people saying, "Oh, cool, who are you gonna have with Chip? Are you gonna have Nora? No. Are you going to have? Oh, they named another black writer. Right. It's like no." Who are you? Oh, no, it was Walter Mosley. Chip was the next month. Walter Mosley. So, but it was the same bit. Are you going to have Chip with Walter? No. Are you going to have Nora? No. And this is at ReaderCon. And down the hall comes along Paul DiFilippo, who writes science fiction, but dips his pen into mysteries. Mm-hmm. And I had Walter Mosley, who writes mysteries, but dips his pen into science fiction.
Oh, well, that works out perfectly.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, you want a box, here's your effing box, okay? This is how we're going to do it. Yeah. And I tried to make boxes like that. So I teamed up Samuel R. Delaney with Sam J. Miller.
Yes, okay, yeah, I think Sam told me about this.
Because they were both named Sam.
I mean, yeah.
That was the connection. People say, yeah, but they both identify as queer. And it's like, oh, I didn't think of that.
Well, I'm thinking just about just writing in general. Like,
well, yeah, they were all. Yeah,
I think that would be a great pairing.
Well, that's it, is that one has to think in terms of pairings. Yeah. And that's exactly how I tried to do the series. So, pairing with N.K. Jemisin is Kai Ashanti-Wilson, with whom I was not familiar, except that Nora told me about him. And so, and now I'm embarrassed, because I should have known. His stories, Super Bass and the Devil in America, are both available at Tor.com.
I love Devil in America.
It was available for free yesterday. I just found out. I found out a day too late. If you went to, actually, depending on where you live, it's probably still available. You go to tor.com, you will see.
Yeah, I read it when it was that you, tor.com.
Yeah, but it's now, it's $1.99, but today it's free. So if you're in a part of the, actually, it's probably still there, but act now. And his first name, by the way, is spelled K-A-I. And he did a story called Kaiju Maximus, with a copyright, a registered symbol after that, for Lightspeed magazine, which I've heard of. And he has novellas, The Sorcerer of the Wild Deeps and A Taste of Honey. Oh, it's Taste of Honey. No, sorry. It's Sorcerer of the Wild Deeps that's available at Tor.
Okay.
One way or the other, you go to tor.com.
There's
stuff by Kai Ashanti-Wilson. More, his novelette, Legendaire, celebrates the legacy of science fiction grandmaster Samuel R. Delaney. My God, this is circular. Which was published by Rosarium Press.
Yes, and Bill Campbell's a good friend of mine. So.
He does wonderful stuff there. Published Carlos Hernandez's wonderful book, the title of which, if I say I'll get wrong, The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Santo. Oh.
I can't help you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
There's no help for me. Carlos, I'm sorry. Everybody look up the name Carlos Hernandez. Buy the book. It's
and Rosarium in general.
Yeah, they haven't published a bad thing, have they? They're really, really good. Bill Campbell's a wonderful publisher.
He has a great eye.
Yeah, he does. Needs audiobooks, but we'll talk about that.
We'll talk about
Yeah, indeed. And Carlos is a great reader. And his partner, C.E. Cooney, is a professional narrator. So, yes. So you know, yes. Mind's World. So this coming Tuesday, 388 Atlantic Avenue, 7 p.m., you want to show up at 6:30, right? Because you want to get coffee or wine or food or whatever. You want to meet the writers, including this year's Hugo Award-winning Best Novel writer and Kaya Shante Wilson. And enjoy. If you can't be here live, well, we're on live stream. You can watch, but you can't get autographs. You can't physically rub elbows. If you do, you're going to have to wash that computer screen when you're done. So do come by 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is by suggested donation, but we will turn away nobody for lack of funds. Yeah, well, you know, that's how it goes. It's why we take a loss every reading, darn it. But hey, it's worth it. It really is. I've got to figure out Patreon or whatever.
Yeah.
Some methodology. I've even had Margot Atwell of Kickstarter on the show, and she's a decent friend and stuff like that. But running a Kickstarter campaign is like a full-time job.
I've never done it, but it's tough.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
If you're going to do it seriously.
Yeah, if you're going to do it, you have to do it right. And you have to take off about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And do nothing but that for 6 weeks. And I don't have that time. So I'll be looking for another funding method. But in the meantime, the series goes on. We're in our 26th season. The next reading after that will be November 1st, which will be All Souls Day, All Hallows Day, the evening before is better celebrated, but because the first Tuesday of the month is All Souls Day, we'll take that, and that will be the first of the annual Margot Adler Memorial Reading Series. And given what Adler did, it could be about radio, it could be about journalism, it could be about Wicca, it could be about science fiction, it could be about fairy, it could be about anything. Almost anything but, oh, and especially vampires.
Okay, we got to talk about that.
Yes.
Because actually, I'll tell you. Something I'm writing currently.
Interesting, because I wonder if your ears were burning.
Possibly.
We can't talk about this on the air, because I'm not curating it. I'm producing it.
Okay.
I've given Terrence Taylor the onus of curating it. And he's written a couple of really good vampire novels, but he's also, which Margot reviewed on NPR, and she really liked them. But he's also our tech director, which means that if he's going to be reading, I've got to be doing the video. I know audio. I've been doing audio 49 years. Yeah. Next May is my 50th anniversary at this radio station.
Oh, my God. You got to do something. But
suicide's illegal.
I was going to say something involving cake, man.
Yeah.
Cake is better than that.
Yeah. Something.
Cake is better than most things.
Yeah, I suppose so. A digital watch, maybe. I don't know.
I know you said you're diabetic, but cake.
Yeah. Oh, there are very good foods.
Absolutely.
For diabetics.
I'll bake you something.
Ooh, if I'd known you was coming, I'd have baked a cake.
I'm very good at baking. I'm
ooh,
not gonna be shy about
that's the one thing I don't cook. I cook exceedingly well,
but
I don't bake. But as far as cooking is concerned, I understand that Maria Devana Headley and I are going to have a showdown this December.
Really?
We each have December parties. I have mine near Saturnalia. That is the holiday I choose to celebrate in December, is Saturnalia, which is a fortnight but the center of it is generally considered December 17th. Mm-hmm. And the highlight of Saturnalia is during, the Hour of the Wolf. Mm-hmm. That twilight time where they're living so far north that the twilight, it's like 3 or 4 hours long. The Hour of the Wolf is not an hour. It's like 3 or 4 hours. Yeah. In New York, it's about 4 minutes. So that's... And last year, people just weren't coming to my party. It's like, why not? Oh, I have another party, says Bolander. And I says to her, oh, really? And I found out that Maria Devonna Headley actually lived in Brooklyn.
Everybody lives in Brooklyn.
Yeah, now.
Everybody. It's weird.
I'm from Queens, but I moved to Brooklyn like 20 years ago.
Well,
and now BAI... Only 2 years ago, we were in Harlem.
Seriously?
Yeah. No, well, yeah. We were at CUNY. We were at City University of New York.
Okay.
Using part of a station there, we had been flooded out of our previous headquarters during Hurricane Sandy.
Oh.
We were in a tall building, but it all shorted out at 120 Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And there were many people that felt that a place like BAI oughtn't be on Wall Street. Yeah, yeah. Okay, you're there. Okay, so that was it. But I really like this building. It's funky.
It's a nice building.
It's a nice building. All we need is a studio instead of just a room. You know that the walls don't even go to the ceiling, and we call it a radio station.
Oh my God, they don't.
You just noticed.
Just
when I told you that there was no soundproofing,
really
I really wasn't number one-ing you. You see the list of the Carlin seven words behind you?
Okay, well, it's good that I've got that for reference point because, oh, no, like most of those are my favorite words.
Yeah, but you see, some of those aren't even legitimate because the FCC doesn't care about number seven or number two.
I was going to say, when did number seven get to be a problem?
Because that's one of Carlin's words.
And
that is somebody here, not even the current management, previous management's interpretation of what is not allowed by the FCC. What, piss? No, you can't even say it. No, those are not, you know, those are allowed in prime time television, two of those words.
Yeah,
they are, and in Carlin's routine, he even says this is not a dirty word. This is not a word that you can't say on television.
Yeah.
And he's right, because you hear it all the time.
Yeah.
In fact, number one was the name of a TV show starring William Shatner, right? It was Bleep, my father said. That was the name of a series about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Didn't watch it. Sounded awful.
If you put that little asterisk or whatever in there, suddenly it's mysteriously fine.
Yeah, and then you can have, you know, Teller and Penn doing it and all the rest. But so you see, it's not about that. I once had Pat Cadigan on the show, and I told her about the seven words and all that. And she said, oh, and she read something on the air that I can't even tell you. She didn't use one of the words, but it was this wonderful and totally relevant sex scene.
Mm, okay.
Using words like labia and...
Those are fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but it's what you do with it.
Oh, well,
that
I
isn't.
I know. I just mean, like, technically nobody can...
Well, yeah, but just on the word. It's, however, what the FCC, in fact, really mandates is, quote, indecency. And there's no defining that.
There really is not.
There really is not. It's
there
the old, whichever Supreme Court person says, you know, I know pornography when I encounter it. And they said, how do you know? And he says, it gives me an erection.
I mean, like I told you, I'm helping out with that First Amendment course. I cannot wait until we start talking about pornography. That's going to be, like, the most fun class for me.
No doubt. It's going to be audited like nobody's business.
They're going to have to force me to shut up. I have so many feelings about
So who am you? Who's Sonny Moraine? I know you. I am. Okay, so I do the audio editing for Lightspeed Magazine and Nightmare Magazine, both edited by John Joseph Adams. And I'm the host of Lightspeed, the voice of Lightspeed. But professional actors read the story superbly, all coming from Skyboat Media. And a number of times I had encountered stories by Sonny Moraine. And was it at CapClave last year or at ReaderCon this? No, 2 years ago, I see this woman in the hallways with the name tag that matched that.
It must have been ReaderCon 2 years ago.
Yeah, I'm thinking. Yeah. And so I thought, okay, you know, I'm not into horror, a particular kind of horror, which I didn't even know was called body horror.
Really?
You taught me that.
I did.
Yes, you did.
Okay, that's a point of pride for me, though.
Yeah, and I mentioned it to Ellen Datlow, you know, saying, oh, yes, Sonny told me all about, what's it called? And she said, what, body horror? I said, yeah, I hadn't heard that. And, you know, she just gave me one of her looks, like, Jim.
I have to say, I've actually never met Ellen. So.
Oh, God.
I know. You'd think I would, given what I write, but no, I've never met her.
No, that needs to change. That needs
to
change. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. You two need to meet. But at any rate, because she's wonderful. She really is. Mm-hmm. So I learned that. So I'm not good. I continue to actively dislike body horror in cinema.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't, you know, I will never see Saw.
Well, no, see, actually, I would argue that that's not body horror.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I haven't seen it, so I can't.
No, I think body horror is a fine, there's a fine distinction between torture porn.
Hostile?
Okay, no, that's torture porn.
Yeah.
Body horror is much more cerebral. Cronenberg is body horror.
See, that's the weird thing, is that I actually sort of like Cronenberg.
Okay, well, come on then. Videodrome is completely body horror.
I liked Videodrome.
Okay, well then,
I winced through it.
Well, you're supposed to.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, duh. The fly is like quintessential body horror.
Yeah, well, you see, there.
I have a hard time with some parts of the fly.
I had serious difficulty with that one. I really did. I'll take the Vincent Price one.
But that's how I knew it was really good, was when I was having a hard time looking at it.
And the thing that I held against The Thing, the John Carpenter thing.
Which I also love.
I recognize, I do not dispute the art of Carpenter or Wes Craven or any number of these people. It's just not for me. It's just a choice that I make. And there is a point in The Thing where somebody's ankles are separated from the rest of their body.
Extremely violent.
It really is. Yeah. It's really...
It's definitely not everybody's taste.
Yeah.
That movie, but,
yeah. I saw how it was well done,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to the Howard Hawks version.
Which
Oh,
the
my God.
Or?
No, it's a Howard Hawks movie. What Howard Hawks movie wouldn't use... yes, I know that the credit is given to Christian Nyby.
Well, and also you got to remember that I'm, like, in my very, very early 30s, and there's a lot of stuff I haven't seen.
You're a kid.
I'm a kid.
You're a kid.
Although, I don't know. Sometimes
you're a professor, but you're a kid.
I'm not a professor.
You're a teacher.
Barely. When I'm getting paid a professor's salary, then you can start calling me a professor.
Okay.
That's what I tell my students.
But I know people like you and of similar age, like Veronica Shaness and all that, who are professors. And
yeah, there are people my age who are professors. That freaks me out.
Yeah, yeah, it does too. It does me too.
Like people my age with kids.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah. Oh well, I mean, I am at a point where the majority of guests on my show were born after I started the show.
Oh, God, yeah. I guess
think about that.
Yeah.
The show started in 1972.
Oh,
You didn't.
No, so. I started in 1984.
Okay, exactly. Yeah, you know, and it's like, I mean, even Gordon Van Gelder, I knew what I was doing the day he was born, because he was born the same day Star Trek first broadcast.
Really?
Yes, he was born September 8th, wow. 50 years ago. That's, happy birthday, Gordon.
That's extremely appropriate.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
So, there it is. Although, at that point, I was actually volunteering at BAI at that point, you know, answering, you know, sweeping floors, fetching coffee for the likes of Samuel R. Delaney, Joanna Russ, Tom Dish, Ted Sturgeon. There was a crew of people at this radio station in them days, let me tell you, which is why I stayed here.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. But so the reason I was talking about body horror and all that is I was encountering your fiction and discovering that while I was wincing,
which you should be,
through some of it, when I was done, it was like, whoa, wait a minute. That was actually really good. I really liked that. I thought I didn't.
That, by the way, when people say that kind of thing, that is like the highest praise I can imagine. I don't usually like this kind of thing, but those are like my favorite words to hear.
Yeah, but this isn't I don't usually. This is I actively avoid.
Actively avoid. That's even better.
I had to do it because it was my job.
Right.
I was audio editing the reading. Okay, who is buzzing me? One second. Hi, Max.
Turn on your microphone.
You're kidding me. Oh, my God, they pressed. Okay. All righty. Thank you. Your mic wasn't working.
It wasn't?
No.
Oh, no. Oh, God. Okay,
well, you can be heard faintly through mine.
Well, that's still not exactly.
You see, it was turned on.
Yeah.
But it was also turned. Okay, there the pot was up.
Okay.
But there are these on and off buttons.
Okay.
Which somebody had turned off.
So it's on now?
It's.
Okay.
I should have been wearing my headphones. I still can't hear anything through the headphone. Wait, tap your mic. It's on.
It is? Okay, good.
Yeah. In fact, mine is barely on. Well, I just turned it down now, but yes.
Oh, and here I am being all charming, and no one can hear me.
Well, no, you could be heard. Max heard you.
Well,
or rather, Max didn't hear you, so he called. Okay. Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Max.
Every week I'd say, thank you, Max. You know, I used to be a really good engineer.
Used to be.
Well, I used to have a professional broadcast console.
Oh, okay.
In front of me.
So that is not what you have now.
The computer I can operate, it's this little mixing board. This is not a broadcast console.
Okay,
this
I would not know that if I looked at it.
Yeah,
I would have no idea what I was looking at.
Yeah, well, it's a mixing board. This is
not the same thing. Okay.
No, not the same thing.
Okay, you got to remember, like,
oh,
the
I promised
thing
Frank
Audacity,
Heller.
So.
I promised Frank Heller I would take a picture of this, too.
A picture of what?
The board and all that. Yeah. This is a fellow who, when he left WBAI quite a few years ago, went to work for Mackie. You know, one of the, you know, the big, Mackie is also the, you know, not just a dress designer. There's a different Mackie who is like the designer of boards.
Mm-hmm.
Audio boards that are like the best in the world. This is not that.
Okay. I mean, it to my untrained eye, it looks impressive.
Yeah, I'll show you a broadcast console later.
I'm looking at all those knobs and I'm like, what could those possibly do?
Nothing involving the broadcasting of radio.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Huh. Okay.
I mean, you know, we really let, you know, taking a look, you know, we don't need equalization on each and every potentiometer pot.
Okay.
On here, we don't need these on-off buttons. This is a mixing board for putting together pre-recorded materials.
Okay.
More or less, that has been retrofitted by people in order to allow us to broadcast from here.
All right. Okay. I'm now envisioning the distinction a bit.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I'm interested in these things.
Ah, well.
I'm interested
tell you
in
more
everything.
About it off the air. Yes.
I'm interested in everything.
So you are. So you are. Which is what makes your writing so fascinating.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
So, when did you begin writing?
When did I begin? Okay, well, no, but that is a problematic question because...
Okay.
The issue there is, what do you consider writing? And mm-hmm. a lot of people have different answers to that question.
Yeah.
When did I begin writing? When I was three, maybe?
Three, four? Yeah, that's the real answer. When did you start writing for publication?
I started writing for publication. Well, I am purposefully not counting stuff in my high school literary magazine because I was not paid for that. When did I first start writing? Let's see, it was right around the time I got into grad school, so... Oh my God, it was like almost 8 years ago. I sold my first paid publication was a $5 piece of microfiction to Circlet Press, and it was lesbian alien erotica.
Okay, well, that's what I expect Cecilia Tan to be publishing.
Yes, and I will love Circlet and Cecilia Tan forever because basically that's where my career got started.
Okay.
Yeah, and I got $5 for it, and I was like, okay, this is lunch.
That's a professional sale. Yeah.
I can clearly do this for money, so let's see what else I can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good start. When did you start selling to larger... Circlet Press has a devoted readership.
Yeah. Not huge, but devoted.
Not huge, but it's... It's a niche.
Yeah.
To start with, it's erotica. To continue with, it's not necessarily straight erotica.
It's not the kind of erotica that's really making all the money these days, for the most part. This kind of thing is always a little problematic to say, because there's always the possibility that some people will read it wrong or take offense to it, but I think it's much more interesting than most of the commercial erotica out there, mm-hmm. the stuff that Circlet Press publishes.
Yeah. Why? Oh, now why is that up? Jeez. I don't know why people would be the stuff that's making the money.
I don't want to disparage that stuff because I think that the people who can make money that way, I mean, all the respect to them. And a lot of it's really good, but I personally don't find it as interesting as the kind of stuff that Circlet publishes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I mean, usually the better stuff is on the fringes.
Yeah, and the Circlet is very fringe in a lot of ways.
Yeah, very, very much so. But Circlet is also one of the very first presses to became the exception that proved the rule about self-publishing. Mm. Because Cecilia Tan was doing a lot of her own fiction at a time when anybody who did that was just vanity press.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was therefore disparaged just on those grounds.
Yeah, this was before Create Space and Lulu and whatnot.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, well before that. Yeah. Long before that. So she was really ahead of her time.
Mm-hmm. Which doesn't surprise me at all, knowing her.
Yeah, as far as all that is concerned. When did you start being picked up by larger press?
I don't remember exactly when my first Clark's World sale was. I think it was right around 2011. So it's right around the time I got my master's degree, somewhat appropriately. I think right around then. I made a sale to Clark's World, and then I made a sale to Strange Horizons right around then, too. And it's been up and down, but I think at this point, I'm mostly selling to pro markets. And I don't know what that means about career status, but if you want to, you know, measure things by that, then yeah, I guess that's where I am. I have no idea what my career is doing right now.
Yeah.
It's a big question mark for me.
It's being noticed, you know.
Okay.
It's being published in good places.
I like to think so.
Yeah. And there aren't any bound editions of your work yet.
There actually are.
There are. I take that back.
I have a short story collection out right now.
Okay.
Called Singing with All My Skin and Bone.
Of course.
Yeah.
What was I thinking? Yes, I knew that.
Well, it didn't come out that long ago.
Yeah.
And I have...
And who published that?
I have... That's Undertow, okay. Which is an imprint of Cheezing. Beautiful, beautiful books. Really,
Cheezing
really
does some
stuff.
Really interesting Cheezing stuff. For those people not seeing their radio, says Chizine.
Yeah.
Cheezing.
Yeah. Yeah. Weird, interesting... dark fiction, just it's hard to pin down. They just do really, really cool stuff. And Undertow puts out beautiful, unsettling work. It's kind of hard to pin down. But I mean, I think that my stuff fits well there for that reason. Because
mm-hmm.
my stuff is weird, and I like to think kind of hard to pin down a lot of the time.
No.
I never thought I would be a horror writer. I never thought that that's where I would end up. But here I am.
Do you think you would stay that? Do you think that you might be moving into other areas at some point?
No, I don't see that happening anytime real soon. I mean, I've written more straightforward fantasy. I've actually had two novel trilogies published with small presses.
Right.
I have a trilogy called Casting the Bones, which I would consider dark fantasy, and that got published through Mask Press, which is an imprint of Prime. Yeah, it's an imprint of Prime.
Okay.
And then I have another novel trilogy called Root Code, which was actually the first book of that was my first published novel. And the first book of that trilogy is actually out through Samhain Press.
Samhain.
Yeah, I know, but they don't say it like that.
They don't.
No, they don't. And you can yell at them. I'm not going to.
I will.
But the
I just did.
You guys, you're saying it wrong. The other two books in the trilogy, and it's
hey,
it's
this
a
show
long
is created
story.
By Margot Adler. It's Samhain, for God's sake.
I know, and I know
for
you
goddess's
have a problem with
sake.
That.
Excuse
I know
me.
You'd have a problem with that, but for complicated and weird reasons, the other two books in that trilogy are actually published by a different publisher,
mm-hmm.
which is Riptide Press, which is really good. So yeah, I actually have several, and then I have a couple standalones. So yeah, actually I have print
so,
stuff
yeah.
out there. It's
and
just
actually I knew
big.
About those trilogies,
yeah,
and so
big.
I don't know why that even, you know.
Well, it's
because I was looking at your website, which by the way is sunnymoraine.com.
Yes.
It has a different name, but that's how you
sunnymoraine.com.
Yeah, Sunnymoraine. What?
I don't update it nearly enough. I need to start getting back
well,
to it more.
God, ourwolf.com is like a 90s museum piece. I keep up the portion of it for the reading series.
Sheer Cities?
No, predates.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
predates
wow, okay.
GeoCities.
Yeah.
I got ourwolf.com in 1994 before the World Wide Web was commercial.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Wow.
I met my partner online in 1981.
Okay, that is hardcore.
On yeah.
That is amazing.
On BBSs. We are on different BBSs.
I met mine on AOL Instant Messenger.
Yeah, well, you see, that's new stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, as long as it wasn't a chat room.
No, it wasn't. Thank God it wasn't a chat room. No, he tracked me down. It was actually creepier than that.
Ooh, yeah.
He saw my name on a mailing list for kind of a, I guess you'd call it a mailing list for a band we both liked. And he saw I was in the area, and he was like, hey, you know, just so you know, I like this band too, and I don't live that far from you. And yeah.
Yeah, well, in the days of BBSs, you called within your area code, because otherwise it's a long-distance call.
So you right?
God, yeah. No, this is seriously old school.
Yeah. You know, area codes, out of district and all that. So for New York, that was 212 and 718.
Yeah.
And now we've got like 8 area codes, but that was it.
Well, and area codes don't even matter anymore because cell phones.
Right, because you can just say to your phone call, blah, 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 and you don't even know their number.
I don't even think about area codes anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Not to mention exchanges, which are the first, those are the first three numbers after the area code. You have the area code, the exchange, and then the trunk.
This is taking me back to my history of technology courses.
BAI used to have a PBX switchboard that I ran. You know, I love
an actual switchboard.
An actual switchboard with the plugs and all that.
Yeah.
I loved that. It was great.
That's fun.
And they still use the same terminology. Trunks and PBXs but it's all electronic.
No. But, I mean, the principle's still basically the same.
The principles are the same, and the definitions come from that.
Yeah.
So, you know, people still talk about dialing their phone, but how many of them ever used a dial?
Right.
You know, and all that stuff. But the premise of dialing a phone is the same as it was, but most folk today don't know what a dial is. You know, they watch movies, they see Dial M for Murder or something like that, and they go, oh, gee, is that soap? You know, at any rate. Trying to roll back to what we were talking about.
It's a fool's errand. We're just going to wander all over the place because I think we encourage each other.
That's the problem because there just isn't enough time.
There really isn't. I'll just have to come back.
Absolutely. Because we did a recording at ReaderCon. We were Sonia Tafe was there before you. I had allowed 2 hours. And that was going to be like a 45-minute interview. And when you showed up, she and I were still going on.
Yeah.
And that
and
was
you and
great.
I went for a long
and time. And then I had you scheduled for 45 minutes, and we went for about 90.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, seriously? We have to stop?
Yeah, because at that point, they were closing the room. It was dinner time. I had a panel.
We were having so much fun.
Yeah. So this is part two.
Yeah, and those are two more parts.
And there will be continuing. Speaking of Sonia Tafe, Nursif reading, November 15th. Okay, so November 1st, I mentioned, are the Margot Adler readings. November 15th, just because she'll be in town, Kitch Johnson will be here. And I decided, who is a good pairing for Kitch Johnson? Sonia Tafe will be. So that will be November 15th. And then, because I was cajoled by a publicist, who shall go unnameless, James Gates, who was representing a book called Cyberworld, and said that she could get me Alyssa Wong and E. Lily Yu and Matt Kressel. Well, Matt can get any old time. But you see, he won't. I was going to say he won't read at his own reading series, except that he is going to be reading at KGB like next month, which when he told me that, they had Alyssa Wong tonight.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, jeez. But, you know, I didn't check. It's my fault. It's on me at any rate. But but that's still a great lineup.
Yeah.
And then December is our family month, where, you know, you have to, you know, December, that you always bring out the families. And so we do the same family every year, Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman. And, God, it's got to be like their 12th year, I think.
Oh, seriously? Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
Doing that for us. I mean, they've been together longer, but. Mm-hmm. As the official Nursif family holiday reading series, it's been Delia and Ellen with special guest host who doesn't care to be identified on the air. So people have to actually show up to the readings to find out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the schedule for this half of the year.
Exciting.
And then I'm figuring out the second half of the year later. But right now, it was like, yeah, three readings. Actually, if you include Ellen and Delia, that's four readings in 7 weeks.
Wow.
A lot of work.
That's a lot of work, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is. But anyway, yeah, you would dial the area code. So you wouldn't go to the long-distance BBSs. If you even went to Long Island, 516 area code, you were paying 7 cents a minute or something like that.
Oh, my God.
But whereas in 212 or 718, it was 7 cents or a dime, and you could just stay on. And one person could be online at a time. And you went and you read your messages and you posted your messages and you went away. And at one particular BBS, we had what was called a meaningless hang. This is old-time BBS talk.
Okay.
And a lot of the phrases and things on BBSs came from fandom.
Yeah, knowing what little I know about it, that doesn't surprise me. And, like, the lots and lots and lots of crossover with those communities.
Yeah, the BBS people never knew that fandom was using smileys, what people now call emojis, in the 1940s.
Wait, seriously?
Absolutely.
1940s?
In fanzines.
Oh, my. Okay, I'm super embarrassed that I didn't know that. But now I know it.
Yeah.
And it's awesome.
This is not a new thing.
Oh,
people were putting
God.
Out their fanzines of different kinds.
I mean, I know fanzines.
The word
really
fanzine
old, but...
comes from both baseball fandom and science fiction fandom in the 1920s. We're not quite sure which. Nobody's quite sure which came first.
I didn't know that phrase dated back that long either. I thought maybe 1960s, 1950s.
Yeah, no. The idea of it was the rock fanzine. That made the word popular in main media. And that was partly the fault of he who had so many faults, David Hartwell,
who
worked with Paul Williams to create Crawdaddy, which became one of the first major rock magazines before Rolling Stone. Mm. It was a fanzine. And that's what brought the word into the mainstream.
I'm learning so much
that
I should have known before now.
There are websites dedicated to fanish history and
I'm like really, really embarrassed.
And a lot of the BBS stuff, you know, it shouldn't surprise people that geeks are geeks.
Oh, well, yeah, no, it doesn't surprise me at all. It's still true.
And in that era, to call somebody a geek or a nerd was disparaging.
Yes. No, I remember, like, I'm not that young. I do remember that.
Yeah, but a lot of millennials don't know that.
Yeah, well, I'm way, 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 way on the older end of millennial.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So the...
I love that that's no longer true, by the way.
Yeah. So it would not be a surprise to find that the main group of people that, you know, you'd call one BBS, then you dial another and another.
Mm-hmm.
And another. And of course you'd run into the same people because there are only so many things. So that's where I met my partner. In a meaningless hang, about 20 of us all went to see the movie, God help us, Willow.
Oh, wow. Okay.
On opening day. So that's how I know the date.
That's really great.
And
that's really sweet.
Yeah. Actually, but we knew each other for 5 years. Online, we knew each other before we ever actually met in person.
You were doing that before it was cool, that kind of relationship.
But it was sort of cool already. When I got online, there was a guy online who'd been doing it for several years named Uncle Orson. That would be Orson Scott Card. And I started in about 1981. So he started in about 1978 on CompuServe. Which was owned at that time by H&R Block. And then CompuServe was swallowed by AOL.
Yeah.
Because AOL always, you always got a busy signal when you were on AOL.
I never used AOL, but because I had internet through University of Pennsylvania because of my dad, so I never had to deal with that. But I had friends who used AOL, so I was vicariously experiencing.
So AOL bought CompuServe not because they wanted CompuServe or even had to engulf CompuServe, but they wanted the phone lines.
Mm.
So tell us more about your fiction, about, you know, what it contains. There is no such thing as a Sonny Moraine story.
There actually isn't. I've sort of tried to think about
those books you mentioned are unlike your stories.
That's, I've actually sort of wondered if that might be a problem career-wise, in that I don't really do one thing. I mean, I've written stuff that's been marketed as romance. Now, I didn't necessarily agree with that particular decision, but, you know, whatever. That's actually the book that gets marketed as romance is the first book in the Root Code trilogy, Line in Orbit, and that's still where I get most of my royalties from. God help me. But it's at this point, I would say probably if you had to make me describe a Sonny Moraine story, it would be dark and weird and uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I'm working out a lot of issues.
Okay.
I'm working out a lot of issues. And I'm sort of working up to going into some uncomfortable places in... I mean, okay, so here's the thing. One of my favorite books on writing is Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird. And one of the, it's one of the two books, whenever people are like, okay, what's good writing books? I'll say that this is one of the two good books, and the other one is On Writing by Stephen King.
Mm-hmm.
Those two books are the books I'm like, okay, if you're going to pay money for any writing books, which I think is a questionable decision anyway, I would suggest that you buy these two. And one of the things that Anne Lamott says that really resonates with me is that when you go to the places in you that you don't want to go and you use that stuff for material, that's where the good stuff is.
Wow. Okay.
That's where the stuff that really, like, lives and breathes and bleeds is going to be, because that's where all the stuff that's really deeply personal is. And people will be able to tell that when they read your stuff. So I have a lot of baggage, and I've been opening it up.
People say that a lot about horror writers, that who I find as a group of people are usually among the coolest and nicest people that
that's
one will
really
meet.
That's true. They're lovely, lovely people.
Yeah, they really are. I met Stephen King once.
He's
just when
so
Carrie
sweet.
Came out. Yeah. You know, yeah, but I beat him in pinball, so there.
Well, yeah, okay, that's awesome.
You know,
well, and yeah, and he went on to have, you know, some fairly serious problems with substance abuse, probably, you know, because issues. But yeah, it's...
Yeah,
our writers
but
are wonderful.
He was a charming person. Gay and Wilson, just like, you know, wonderful, charming, old-style horror, Robert Bloch.
Yeah.
These are among, and I met actually a couple of members, believe it or not, I was on the young side and they were on the older side, but I met a couple of people of the Lovecraft Circle, like Frank Belknap Long. I mean, people who actually, of that era, of the Lovecraft era, writing the Cthulhu mythos as they were being made up. So, but they were nice.
Yeah.
You see, now there's the exception, right? Lovecraft.
Yeah, let's not even talk about him.
Yeah, there's no need. There's no
there's
need.
Really not.
But as we approach Roald Dahl's 100th birthday, which is being celebrated right around now. I guess it's just coming up, or we've just passed it.
I'm not
something.
Sure which either, but yeah, it's
but,
right
around. But everybody is doing it. Let us not remember that he was in many ways a vile man, an anti-Semite of the worst water. People can just look that up. And yet, I adore his writing.
It's wonderful writing.
His dark fiction, his children's books, even his James Bond film. He wrote You Only Live Twice.
Really? Yes. I don't think I actually knew that.
Yeah, he wrote the screenplay for you and the story for You Only Live Twice. And there's a little trivia for folk.
That makes me really happy.
I'm into Bond trivia. So, and that's one of the better Bond films.
I actually think that's a Bond film I haven't seen. And I like Bond films.
And Sean Connery.
Yeah, well.
So it's a definitive one.
Yes.
And it's got its problems. Problems of the era and all that, you know, where...
Yeah.
Okay, so here's this wonderful woman and all that, and Bond falls in love with her, so she must die.
Well, obviously, because he has to have feelings about it.
Four or five minutes, they find a clone of her.
Oh, okay.
As it were, you know. And because they're replaceable.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, you just swap them out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only Bond film, the only two Bond films that ended with real pathos were On Her Majesty's Secret Service, where they killed Diana Rigg, and any movie that kills Diana Rigg, you know, and George Martin, if you ever hear this, Game of Thrones, don't do it. I don't watch Game of Thrones for reasons we've discussed earlier.
I stopped watching Game of Thrones.
I stopped about episode 8. Yeah, even before Ned was dead.
You were smart. You got out early. I stuck around.
When I saw there was a sword battle in a courtyard, and the camera closed in on arterial spurting.
You stopped watching for different reasons.
And I looked away. I looked away. And then, because it's usually a pattern to these things, but they're very good at their craft on Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
I looked back, and there it was again. And it was like there is no avoiding the gore, the gornography.
It's soaked in gore.
The horrifying sex, abuse.
I have problems with that on a different level than the gore.
Yeah.
Really different level.
Yeah,
I don't have any problems with the gore.
But it was the really visual, as I say, arterial spurting was the one step too far. It's like if you show it for a moment, that's one thing. But when you linger and when you make sure that the people who know to look away, that you break that rhythm so that you're going to make sure that they see it and linger on it.
That's a fine line to draw, yeah.
Yeah, it was very well done. There's no question about it. It's not me. And I can't go there and people say, hey, you know, Diana Rigg's on it, one of my favorites, of course, right?
Well, yes.
She's
wonderful.
Yeah, but I can't watch it. I can't watch it. I knew George Martin when he lived in Hoboken. I love his writing. I love his science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not into this one series he's got, which, you know, bought him a nice part of New Mexico. But
I stopped watching it just because it started feeling emotionally abusive. Everybody I like dies. It's like, I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore.
Well, that was there from season one.
But I stuck with it because I was emotionally invested enough in other characters, but they all kept dying and being miserable for reasons that I didn't completely agree with.
I blame all this killing of characters we love totally on Joss Whedon.
Oh, God.
I think
I had to remind myself there are certain words you cannot say on the air. Yeah, Joss Whedon.
Yeah, but we have numbers.
We do.
Yeah, it's like, number one, Joss Whedon.
Number three, Joss Whedon.
Oh, well, there's that. Except that he produced a video that was released today, Wednesday anyway, that, you know, just brings him back, a three-minute video that has unbroadcastable material within it. It's a campaign video. It's a get out and vote video.
I'll have to watch that. See, the thing genius. Is, I love his work. I just have so many individual problems with him and with so much of it. I love Buffy. I love Angel. I love Firefly. I love Dr. Horrible. I thought the Avengers film was okay.
The first Avengers film was wonderful.
I thought it was okay. Iron Man films are still very much my thing, but for a lot of reasons.
But the Avengers, first Avengers film is an Iron Man film, but with more Scarlett Johansson.
Well, and that's always a plus.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I got issues with Joss Whedon, and the killing characters for the hell of it is...
Well, that's very much a Whedon thing, which he couldn't get away with in Marvel. Otherwise, he would have killed half the characters.
Yes, and then they wouldn't have magically come back.
But, you know, that started in Buffy poking out Xander's eyes, you know, and...
Well, and see, but the thing is, I agree with decisions like that when they serve a greater purpose, and it's not just to be like, look, I'll kill anybody. Nobody's safe, which is a complete lie. And I personally find that kind of boring. I mean, I really enjoy writing stories where people are miserable. I just very much believe that misery has to serve a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't personally like writing stories that are completely hopeless.
Right. And despite the fact that you write body horror.
Yeah.
There is something that you are left with at the end that has light.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, what I love about body horror, and this is kind of why I love Cronenberg so much, is that, and this is especially true in the title story for my short fiction collection, Singing with All My Skin and Bone, the body horror is actually about the reclamation of power. I'm very interested in, this is something I'm continuing to tease out as I write, although I haven't really addressed it directly in a while. The destruction of someone's body as a kind of powerful transformation. So in Singing with All My Skin and Bone, I mean, it's about self-harm, but it's about self-harm as blood magic. And it was actually, that's a very autobiographical story. I have a particular kind of obsessive compulsive disorder where I compulsively self-harm. I'm covered in scars from it, and I did it a lot when I was a kid. And you know how kids are. They don't understand mental illness. All they know is that this person is weird and they're doing gross things. And I got so much hell for it. And years later, I mean, I was doing kind of what I said. I was trying to go into a really uncomfortable place. And I was like, this is... The actual name for this is dermatillomania. And I've talked to people with dermatillomania. And one of the common through lines that comes up again and again is, I can't even talk to a therapist about this. It's that gross and that embarrassing. Because, I mean, you're clawing holes in yourself. And people who don't experience it can't understand it, can't understand the compulsion to do this to yourself. It's not like self-harm when you're depressed. You want to do these things because they feel good in a really awful way. And I was like, I want to write about this because I've been ashamed to talk about it for years. And I want to write about it in such a way that it's actually about power. So I was like, what if it's magic? What if it's blood magic? So it actually ended up being a really empowering story, although in many ways it's also a very horrifying story. I like violence as power in the way that it normally doesn't get written about.
Yeah.
In a very, I guess I would say feminist way, because it's violence as power in a way that doesn't really have anything to do with aggression.
Right, as opposed to the typical violence as power thing vis-a-vis rape, which is just...
Or any...
Violence against women and...
Any kind of masculinized violence. I like writing about violence in a way that is much more feminized.
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways it's kind of uglier and more vicious because of that, in a way that I very much enjoy. One of the stories, the first stories that you encountered by me, the So Sharp That Blood Must Flow.
Oh, God.
My misandrist Little Mermaid story.
Yes, yeah. It really.
Where the mermaid hacks off the prince's legs. I mean, that's like exactly the kind of violence I like writing about.
Yeah. And at the same time, I also thought that it was a very, were you aware of the nasty retort to Hans Christian Andersen that you were giving?
Oh, very much so.
I was hoping so.
I wanted to write a revenge story. I mean, I love the Disney movie, but the original fairy tale is, which I actually really like, but it's also horrifying. And yeah, it's a, in many ways, it's a horror story.
Well, yeah, a lot of Hans Christian Andersen is.
Fairy tales are horror stories in a lot of
very,
ways.
Very often.
Yeah.
The household tales of the Grimms
yeah.
are certainly that. They are, and yeah, now I come from a German background, and the children's stories that my parents would have been raised with Strudelpeter.
I grew up with that story.
Okay.
A really lavishly illustrated version of that story.
Yeah, you saw the one, the edition with the original illustrations?
I probably don't.
They're striking. I mean, if you've
There's
ever...
There's blood
my,
everywhere.
My parents hid them.
My
mother
no.
my had her
were...
German edition, okay? You know, they she barely got out of Germany and Czechoslovakia through the underground, ended
yeah.
up in Casablanca, no less, and then Marrakesh
yeah.
Until they were able to find their way into the U.S. at a time when the U.S., of course, was not allowing Jews
yeah.
to come into the U.S.
Yeah.
Which
we don't talk about.
But
now.
But she was able right. But she was able to bring, eventually, a copy of Der Struwwelpeter.
I
bet it was my uncle. I bet he was mischievous.
It was probably the version I grew up with was probably with the original because they were gruesome.
They really are with
yeah.
the main. Well, Edward Scissorhands, I've always imagined, was designed after.
You know, I never made that connection, but that might be true.
Yeah,
yeah,
there's a great deal of similarity with the black clothes
yep.
and the hands streaming
the scissors,
out, this,
yeah.
Yeah. which are straw that are set to fire, of course. And,
yes.
And there was an off-Broadway production.
Really?
Which I never saw. It was called Shock-Headed Peter, which is close to
yeah.
Struwwelpeter. But I mean,
yeah.
my God, people have no idea. You
it's
think that
horrifying.
The Grimm stories, properly
yeah.
translated, are dark with all these toes being cut off and eyes being gouged
yeah,
out.
Yeah, and I grew up on those, too, with the Cinderella, where they're, you know, the slippers are full of blood because they're hacking off bits of their feet so that they fit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I grew up with that.
Aschpudel.
Yeah.
Let's give her her proper name, Aschpudel.
Yeah.
Well, the
yeah.
whole Cinderella thing alone comes from so many different cultures,
lots
and
difference.
It's a fascinating, fascinating thing alone.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Grimm version collection of Aschpudel is really, yeah, it's well portrayed as in Into the Woods. It's fairly accurate. The James Lapine, Stephen Sondheim musical, even the Disney movie.
Which I haven't seen.
It's problematic insofar as they took a stage experience and made it a movie.
That's always going to be a difficult transition.
It always is. And it was very important, and it's generally true of most Sondheim musicals, that Act One is a cessation and then Act Two is... Okay, let's modify Act One. This is the way Sondheim tends to work.
Mm-hmm.
So Act One ends with, and everybody lives ever after.
Mm-hmm.
And Act Two is, oh yeah?
Yeah.
And brings in the very dark, very serious issues.
Yeah.
Very serious issues at that point. But through Act One, you know, even in Act One, yeah, you've got the hacking of the toes
yeah.
and the removal of the heel and the blood and the blinding and the gouging.
Yeah.
And it's all, it is all in there.
It
is
all
in even the Disney version of Into the Woods, amazingly. Rob Marshall directed, so he did a fairly accurate translation of it. But it has issues, but it's still very good.
Yeah.
I miss Bernadette Peters, though. Meryl Streep did an okay job.
I'll have to see it.
Yeah, yeah. It's worthwhile. But yes, household tales
yeah.
as the Grimms, they didn't call them fairy tales. Perrault.
Yeah.
I think Charles Perrault really did that. Oh, God, Rick Bowes can lecture on this stuff forever and ever. He's very good at it because he wrote a collection of fairy tales for Aqueduct Press that really follow that. There are a few writers. You've touched on it, but you get very dark, darker than, say, Theodoric Oss. Or there are a lot of people who are playing with the form.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something I've moved away from a bit. I was messing around with fairy tales for a while just because, well, folk tales. Because, you know, it interested me. And I also thought, okay, well, I'm having a hard time thinking up completely original ideas, so let me take this pre-existing one and see what I can turn it into.
Mm-hmm.
But I've kind of drifted away from that a bit, I think.
Yeah, but people come back to it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I will at some point.
Yeah, Genevieve Valentine did her version of The Seven Dancing Princesses.
Yeah, it's an endless well.
A 1920s flappers.
Yeah,
thing.
There's so much you can do.
Ellen Zatlow and Terry Windling did how many anthologies?
Mm-hmm.
And Ellen Kushner has played in that universe, and
there's so much to do.
We're approaching October, by the way. I think we're assuming I'm on the air during fundraising time, we'll have to revisit Tamlin for all those people who like their folk tales, gory and filled with stuff. All those nice, fun Steel I Span songs. Pardon me, they don't have time on my 90-minute show to play anymore.
Yeah.
They're really just filled with gore and revenge and stuff like that. And all these pretty ditties. And then you listen to the lyrics and, you know, and it's like, you know, down goes the thin blood before the viscous part flows into the drain.
Jeez.
Great stuff.
It is good stuff, yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you're right that my stuff is really dark. And I don't think that's going to change. I thought I was going to be a science fiction writer of, you know, kind of more of the... I mean, my dad was a big Heinlein fan, and I grew up on a lot of classic science fiction. More fantasy. I grew up with a lot of Tolkien. And I grew up with Tolkien and Lewis. But... I was also kind of raised to some degree in classic science fiction, and I thought that was what I was going to do. And no, I'm just doing all dark, disturbing things.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of Tolkien and Lewis can be pretty dark.
Very dark, yeah. Yeah.
And
Lewis, more than you'd think.
Yeah, Out of the Silent Planet.
Yeah, my mom really loves that. I really like Till We Have Faces, which is... I don't know if I would consider that really dark, but it's definitely one of his more adult stories in a lot of ways. It really goes deep into some heavy psychology. Actually, should reread that. It's been a while.
Okay. I am corrected by a text from no less in Bulgaria. Ashenputtel. Well, you say it your way, Bobson. I'm telling you the way that my parents, one from Nuremberg, the other from Frankfurt,
Oh, damn. Okay.
Okay, Ashputtel is the way it was told to me by my mother Liesl and my uncle Wolfgang. Okay? So, I'll leave that there for the moment.
Well,
Mr. Gaunt liked all my pictures of you.
Oh, that's nice.
That would be John Langan. Great horror writer. Great dark fantasy writer. If you don't know his stuff, Mr. Gaunt is one of his characters.
Okay.
Yeah. You should check that out at some point. But listeners, you know, it's hard to believe we're done.
Really?
Take a look at the clock.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Seriously?
It flies.
I thought we still had another hour.
We should.
Oh, my God. Okay. I'm really
the ideal radio show is 3 hours in my mind.
Yeah,
yeah, but there was a point where I did a different show, not Hour of the Wolf, That was 5 hours. We used to have midnight to
that
5.
That would be perfect.
Oh, I loved 5 hour
shows. That
would
be great.
But that is non-existent on this radio station anymore. Because there are too many people that want their slices.
Mm-hmm.
And times change and philosophies change. And people are given airtime based on how much money they can raise for the station. Which can be problematic.
Yeah.
But we're on our, on the other hand, I can see the other side. We are on the skin of survival here, as you can tell by the inability to build a studio.
Yes, and have any soundproofing. And I didn't even get to talk about my vampire thing.
No, but, well, as you said, you have to come back.
Have to come back.
But what you do have to tell us in the time remaining is where people can find you.
I mean, you kind of already said.
Yeah, well, let's say it again.
My website is...
This time with your mic on.
With my mic on, my website is sunnymorane.com, so SunnyMoraine. I got that right, I think.
Yes.
.com, yeah. And I'm on Twitter as Dynamic Symmetry, all one word.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't know, I'm out there. My books are for sale. I enjoy money, so.
Yeah. and a lot of them are available to read, to sample for free, Clark's World. And
yeah, most of my short fiction's available online.
And Nightmare Magazine.
Most of my short fiction's free.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Yeah, but the novels.
The novels you have to pay for, but the fiction, short fiction you get for free.
Yeah. Yeah. Good morning, Lister.
Good morning.
Hi. Lister, Sunny. Sunny, Lister. So, anyway. I hope it's been worth your while to be not on the air for half an hour because of the mic number 3 up.
Yeah.
And I'm very – it's the second time that's happened, that same specific problem.
Mm.
And my fault is I'm so relaxed in doing this, I didn't wear my headphones or I would have known.
That's terrible.
It is, actually. It is. That one
I'm not upset.
Is on me. I am.
Okay. You can be upset for me,
but we will do more.
We will.
We'll do lots more. You're going to be at Capclave, right?
I will be at Capclave. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think. When is Capclave?
In about 2 weeks.
I'm going to be in Poland.
Oh God!
I just remembered.
You mentioned you were going to Poland.
I'm so annoyed about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I will be in DC. Capclave is.
I hate missing Capclave.
Yeah. Capclave is really nice.
It's a great con. Everybody should go to Capclave.
Yeah. Yeah. Really. ReaderCon and Capclave are my two.
Capclave has gotten so great, and it's better every year.
Yeah.
I'm really mad that I'm missing it, even though I want to go to Poland.
Yeah. Yeah. And what brings you to Poland? I know we're out of time, but you can tell us anyway.
Well, my husband's family is originally from a small village right on the border of Poland, Ukraine, and Slovakia, and we went there last year to do some genealogy, and we liked it so much that we're going back.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that does sound great.
It's a beautiful country. Oh, my God.
Well, what can I say other than it's been way too short a time.
It's been way too short.
And we have to have you read.
Yes.
We're going to work this out.
We're going to work this out.
In the meantime, all I can say is that this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Our guest has been Sunny Moraine. And I'll be back next week at 1:30 a.m. with, John Joseph Adams.
Oh, my
goodness. And Douglas Cohen promoting a book whose name we dare not say on the air because it's in the title.
Mm-hmm.
What the is that? It's the name of the book. And Gravlax, I think, is the word. Gravlax.
Okay.
So we'll explain it all. In the meantime, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Lister. Starring Clapper? No, Burn Baby Burn Clapper, starring Lister. There we go. And we'll work these things out. Maybe I'll figure out how to turn on a mic and do a show without a technical bleep up. But that would be a unique. In the meantime, everybody, please be good to each other. We deserve it. You deserve it.
Yes, indeed.
And all that. Sunny, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.